1 Samuel chapter 20. Let me start with a question. When the wheels are coming off life, when you feel crushed in your faith, when you feel oppressed and persecuted, what do you need? Don't shout out loud. I wonder what your answer would be. What is it that you need in that situation? When everything else is dark, when the enemies are closing in, when maybe you're even fearful of, can I go on anymore? Can I go on in life? What's the point? What is it that will keep you going? Bob's there. Help. Friendship. Particularly what the Bible determines as friendship. That's what we're going to think about this morning. There's loads of confusion in our world about friendship this week, isn't it? I don't recommend it, but if you want to get thoroughly bamboozled about what friendship is, Google it. Okay, so this week, there are 5 C's of friendship, 4 pillars of friendship, 3 C's of friendship, 8 C's of friendship, 14 P's of friendship, and on and on and on and on. Okay, lots of ways people describe different sorts of friendships that work in different ways. You can Google it and find a golden rule of friendship. You can find 7 friendship rules. You can find the 80-20 rule, and so on, and so on, and so on. Google has loads of information on friendship, and yet here's the really interesting thing. As we've produced more and more waffle on friendship, people are lonelier than ever. The World Health Organization has said that the greatest and most threatening pandemic in the world is loneliness. And not just loneliness for people who live on their own, but even loneliness within families and loneliness within communities. And if you do the kind of research, loneliness has massive health impacts. Now, let me just say, that's not just a society issue. I think one of the greatest dangers for the church and for us is that what is in society gets into the church. And I think, sadly, often in church, we mimic the world in that we are confused about friendship, and therefore we don't really have the kind of friendship the Bible calls us to. Let me ask you, do not shout this one out loud. How many friends do you have? I don't mean Facebook, okay? That's not friendship. I don't mean followers. I don't mean acquaintances. I don't mean people you occasionally have a coffee with. I don't even mean people that you love the same program or love the same football team. How many actual friends do you have? People you would turn to in a crisis and know that they would be there for you no matter what. Who at your lowest point you could pick up the phone to and just say help, and they would drop everything and rearrange life to sit with you, weep with you, and change their diary ongoing to strengthen you in your faith. How many have you got? And how revealing is that? Now, one of the shining lights of 1 Samuel, as we've gone through, it's tragic retelling of Saul's kind of rise and then tragic fall as he's turned away from God. One of the shining lights has been the friendship between David and Jonathan. It's a friendship that's been a gift to them from God to develop their faith. If you want to see what friendship is like, that is God's gift to us, that we were made to enjoy, studying David and Jonathan, poring over these chapters and seeing these two men and their commitment to each other as friends matters. And as we've said before, it's a tragic indictment on our world that our world can't look at this and just see two people being friends. It has to bring in romance. Because the Bible's clear here, there is no romance involved. This is what true friendship looks like. And at its heart, isn't 5 C's or 4 C's or rules or the 80-20 rule or any of that? Look at verse 14. What does Jonathan say to David? What's the grounding of his friendship as he prepares to give up everything for his friend? Verse 14, but show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's unfailing kindness as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. What is at the heart of their friendship? It is an experience of and a faith in the unfailingly kind Lord. That's what he says, verse 14. He's saying, look, David, I know you know the God who is unfailingly kind, and I want you to mirror him, mimic him in the way you treat me. There is something distinctive about friendship that has a faith in God and salvation through Jesus at its core. Both of these men are men after God's own heart. As you read through the book, you've seen Jonathan take bold steps of faith. You've seen David take bold steps of faith. Both are devoted to God. And in the midst of a society that's mixed up with its worship and its morality, where everyone does what he or she thinks is right, where even the princess does a bit of God worship and a bit of idol worship, David and Jonathan stand out in their wholehearted devotion to God and their bold lives of faith. And that's the foundation on which this friendship is built. Devotion to God, seeking God's kingdom, and longing to become more like the God they behold. God is unfailingly kind, we're told in verse 14. You can trace that throughout Psalms and throughout all kinds of other places. It's a very specific word. It's the word hesed in Hebrew. And unfailingly kind kind of conveys a little bit of it, but it's one of those Hebrew words that's, you know, a bit like Pandora's box. When you open it, loads of stuff comes out. It speaks of unflinching loyalty. It speaks of unbreakable faithfulness, steadfast love, and inexhaustible commitment. That's a lot to pack into one word, isn't it? That's what God is like towards his people. That's who they know God to be. And the basis of their friendship is because God is unfailingly kind, we can take risks and be unfailingly kind to others, trusting in God's unfailing kindness. That's the foundation of their friendship. And as David is in crisis at the start of chapter 20, on the run for his life, facing death, he needs unfailing friendship. He needs someone to mirror God's character to him, to encourage him. What do you and I need in the midst of a crisis? We need a friend who will mirror God's character to us, who will be unfailingly kind, unflinchingly loyal, unbreakably faithful, steadfastly loving, and inexhaustible in their commitment. Now, this chapter is going to challenge us because it flies in the face of the myth of our own independence. We all tend to be brought up to believe we don't need anyone else, that we can manage on our own, we can make it ourselves. But this passage shows us, no, actually, we are made for friendship. It's interesting when you get to the New Testament, isn't it? What does Jesus do quickly? Gathers around him disciples. Why? So that he can have friends and so he can model friendship. What do you see as they go forward in the Acts of the Apostles? You see them building these kind of friendships that are unfailingly faithful, and yet tragically in the church today, it can be easy to think, I don't need that. I can manage on my own. The danger with that is it leaves us vulnerable when suffering comes or false teaching slips in or Satan whispers to us. We need friends who are unfailingly faithful, where that friendship is built on knowing God. And that's what we're going to see here. I'm just going to show you four things about this unfailing friendship. Here's the first. Unfailing friendship embraces vulnerability. You see how much David needs Jonathan's friendship in the fact that he goes to him, verse 1. He's on the run from Saul for his life. Saul wants to kill him, and David goes to the first place Saul would look because Jonathan is his best friend. We see later on, don't we, verse 30 and 31, Saul knows that Jonathan has made this covenant with David. He knows that he's sided with him. He's an obvious place to him to run, but David is in such need of encouragement in his faith that he goes to see Jonathan. He takes a risk. But I wonder if it struck you that Jonathan's a bit in the dark, verse 20. He doesn't really know what's going on. It might surprise you. Last week, we saw a number of times where Saul tried to kill David. And in the first one, Jonathan's the one who intervenes and brings about a reconciliation between Saul and David. But then you get the battle, verse 8. War breaks out. And it seems likely Jonathan's sent away to defend one of the border towns, one of the territories. And so he doesn't know that Saul has tried to pin David to the wall with a spear again. He doesn't know that he sent men to hunt him in his house and only Michal let him escape. He doesn't know that God has directly intervened and caused Saul's soldiers and Saul himself to prophesy and be overwhelmed by the Spirit when they come to take David. So verse 2, Jonathan is unaware that this reconciliation has broken down. He's in the dark about it. And what strikes you in verse 1 as David comes is the question he asks. What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to kill me? Look down at verse 8. He says, as for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself, why hand me over to your father? It's not just surprising that David goes to Jonathan. It's surprising that he asks him this question. He says to Jonathan, here's the first mark of unfailing friendship. He says to Jonathan, examine my life for sin. That's a big question to ask, isn't it? When did the last time you asked someone that? Over coffee afterwards, I guarantee, unless you're just going to be annoying, you are not going to go to someone and say, please, some of you are laughing because that will be you. Please examine my life for sin. And yet here David goes and he says to Jonathan, Jonathan, you know what's been going on. Will you go to your dad and will you see if in any way I have sinned against him? Is there any way I have acted that would lead Saul to think I'm trying to usurp the kingdom? That I'm trying to take the kingship from him? Jonathan, please examine my life and let me know if I've sinned. And you see how serious about it, as he says in verse 8, if I'm guilty, then kill me yourself. If I fought against God's king, I deserve to be put to death. Examine me for sin. See if I've done anything. That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think mine and your natural response when someone accuses something or when we feel we're being treated unjustly is to what? React angrily and defend ourselves. We very rarely go, actually, is there an element of truth in any of this? Is there something I may have done? Even more rarely do we go to someone else and say, would you just help me examine this situation and see if there is some secret sin I'm not aware of? See, David has examined himself. He can't see any sin that justifies Saul's anger, but he wants Jonathan to have another look for him. Now, that's a hugely vulnerable position to put yourself, isn't it? But look at verse 8. It's founded on experience and trust. As for me, show kindness, that's that Hesed word again, unfailing kindness to your servant. Notice that. Is David trying to usurp Saul's rule? No. Is he trying to usurp Jonathan's rule? No. He sees himself as the servant of the royal family until God brings him into the kingship. But you notice as well, he goes on to say, for you have brought him into a covenant with yourself before the Lord. Their friendship is based on promises they have made to one another. And so David can be vulnerable with Jonathan because he knows his character, he knows the God he worships, and they have committed together to help one another fight sin and seek God's kingdom. That's a strong bond of friendship, isn't it? The New Testament, though, interestingly, assumes that that's the norm in the church. So think of Jesus teaching about planks and specks. So, you know, the idea of someone coming to you and you've got a plank in your own eye and you're busy fixated on the speck in this. He doesn't say don't do any plank or speck work. Just let each other keep sinning. He says sort the plank out so that you can help them sort the speck out. What's he saying? In the church, among disciples, we should just be helping one another fight sin. Think of Philippians 4:3, where there's this conflict between two people in the church. And Paul writes to the church and says, what? Help them. Love them enough. Be unfailingly kind enough to help them see their sin and reconcile. Galatians 6:1, he calls that church to restore those who are in sin. In James 5, he calls them to seek those who wander from the truth. Back in Matthew 18, he says that we are to help one another point out sin with the aim of repentance out of a deep love and commitment. See, this friendship we see with Jonathan and David, this vulnerability that says unfailing kindness means helping one another examine our lives for sin, ought not to be unusual in the church. Now, we can't do it with everyone, okay? It wouldn't be right to do it with everyone. But we mustn't also default to doing it with no one. And I think for too many of us, that's too easy to do, isn't it? Oh, I don't know the right person. Think of an excuse you would make. I bet you can think of loads. Oh, I'm too busy. Oh, but I'm not quite sure I trust them. Oh, but I can't do a Wednesday. Oh, but no. We need others to help us see our sin. We need others to help us examine what we might have done wrong and seek reconciliation in relationships. But it needs to be those whom we know love us and are for us and who display already unfailing loyalty and unbreakable faithfulness. Here's the second thing. Unfailing friendship strengthens one another in the faith. Verses 11 to 23, Jonathan agrees to search out the problem. He's going to go to Saul at great risk to himself, and he will tell him what he finds out. He makes an oath, verse 12, to tell David and protect David. And he encourages David with a blessing in verses 13 and 14. And his prayer, his blessing, encourages him with his certain hope about the future. Look at what he says, the end of verse 13. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live so that I may not be killed. And do not cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Do you notice how future focused he is? David's come to him and David's like, your dad's about to kill me and I'm running out of friends and I don't know what God is doing. And Jonathan says, verse 13, the Lord will be with you and is with you just as he was with my dad before the spirit left his father. And he says, I'm so certain of it, I'm going to ask you, show me unfailing kindness to me and don't cut off your kindness to my family. What's he saying? David, God is going to keep his word. God is going to keep his promises. You can trust him. You will rule and reign over Israel. You will have a dynasty. You will have children that follow you. And through you, God will establish his kingdom. I have no doubt, no matter how bleak it looks now. David, it may look impossible, but trust God, he's saying. Sometimes when our faith is fragile and weak, and we're running on fumes, we need the comfort and the encouragement of somebody else who will strengthen us in God's certain promises and our glorious hope. Faith in God, seeking God's kingdom, covenantal faithfulness, unfailing kindness helps us see and trust in our God. And look at verse 16. Jonathan makes another covenant with the house of David. And what does he say? May the Lord call David's enemies to account. Isn't that staggering? Because who is David saying his enemy is? It's his dad. Jonathan says, look, I love you so much. I am so committed to you that I will pray this, that even if my dad is your enemy, God will bring him to account. Because God keeps his promises. God builds his kingdom. Unfailing friendship strengthens one another in the faith. It believes God's promises. It lives as if they're real, and it shares that belief with those who are struggling. Here's the third thing we see about unfailing friendship. It's that the world can't understand such unfailing friendship. Look at verses 24 to 34. When the feast comes, Jonathan boldly risks everything by faith. When Saul asks where David is on day two, Jonathan does what he agreed to do. And Saul's reaction, his anger, reveals his hatred of David and his opposition to God. As Saul rants against David, did you spot the irony of verse 30? You son of a perverse and rebellious woman. What's the irony? It's not his mum that's perverse and rebellious. It's Saul. Saul is intently stood against God and God's purposes. But Saul knows the cost for Jonathan of David becoming king. As long as the son of Jesse lives, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die. Jonathan, he says, look, wake up. If you keep up this friendship with David, if you protect him, if you seek his kingdom, it's going to cost you everything. That's what he's saying. Saul cannot understand a friendship that would be willing to give up the crown, the place of being a prince, and everything that comes with it for somebody else. And yet Jonathan continues to be faithful to David. Verse 32, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Talk about an understatement. Saul wants David dead. What sin has he done? Absolutely none. You know those moments where you're asking someone what you've done wrong and all they can do is just get more angry and shout because there actually is nothing. That's Saul. Got no reason for it. He's not sinned against me. I just want to kill him. There's no justification for his anger. Saul's anger is sinful and selfish. Jonathan's anger, by contrast, verse 34, is just. He is grieved at his father's sinful, shameful treatment of David when David has done nothing wrong. It's worth just saying, just a side note there, we tend to think anger is always wrong. This anger is good. The problem is often we develop Saul anger, not Jonathan anger. Let's get back to where we were. Jonathan is seeking God's kingdom. And he's given up everything. And notice this, it costs him his father. You know when Jesus says in Matthew that for some people following him will cost them their family. Here you see a picture of it with Jonathan. He's prepared to give up his kingdom, his comfort, his crown, and even give up his good relationship with his father because he stands for God's kingdom. And Saul, with his earthly mind, cannot understand how he would be able to do that. That's not a one-off. It's the pattern of God's kingdom we see again and again and again. It points us forward. Jonathan here points us forward to Jesus, doesn't he? The one who gives up his crown, gives up the splendor of heaven, gives up far more than Jonathan gave up, to come and seek God's kingdom, taking the nature of a servant, humbling himself even to death on a cross, to bring about God's kingdom for his enemies. And even now, when you share that news with somebody, sometimes with people, they think you're mad, because why would you do that? They can't understand. The world cannot understand a love that would forgo power and might and comfort and choose a cross for those it thinks should be one's enemies. And here in Jonathan, we get a little foretaste of what Jesus will do. That's the pattern of the kingdom. Giving up comfort and crown to serve the kingdom and the king. That's what Jesus talks about later on with his disciples, about denying yourself, carrying your cross. It is giving up, like Jonathan does, to serve the king and God's kingdom. The world can't understand God's kingdom. Can't understand how or why we as disciples would give up everything for Jesus. Cannot understand how it might cost us family, career, comfort, a crown. To follow Jesus, to be one who seeks his kingdom, is to be misunderstood by the world, sometimes by family, by friends, by colleagues. But we're to expect it. Jonathan experiences it. Jesus experiences it. The disciples experiences it. The early church experiences it. It's not to lead us to change course, but to commit to seeking God's kingdom and to being that unfailing friend with those in our church family. Here's the last thing this morning. Unfailing friendship fixes our eyes on God's character and God's hopes in verses 35 to 42. As Jonathan goes out in the field and fires his arrow and calls out, "Isn't it beyond you?" David knows. The arrow may not have hit him, but something pierced his heart. And as Jonathan sends the boy back to town and David and Jonathan meet, what do we read? Then they kissed each other, verse 41, a kiss of welcome and faithfulness and promise.